taste the day. That's the kind of morning that don't fade away. Like it, yeah, let it play. Share it, yeah, pass it on your way. Sub up, don't hesitate. David L. Gray in the morning, don't be late. Good morning. This is David L. Gray in the morning. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for being here. This is an off day, though. You know, we stream on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, but today is a special day because we have a special guest. So we're not going to do the typical saint of the day. There's going to be no commentary and readings at Mass, but I do recommend, if you haven't yet, go over to stdominicsmedia.com, sign up for our mailing list, because I do send out the audio version of our Sunday's readings at Mass. If you haven't got my book, The Liturgical Sense of the Readings at the Mass, you can listen to it also for free. So check that out, stdominicsmedia.com. Make sure you sign up and check out our lifetime membership, Become a Hound of Heaven. So we are here today because, like I said, we have an incredible guest. And I'm happy to have on Dr. Felucia Sholaran. She's a licensed psychologist, and she'll be speaking about scrupulosity from a clinical perspective in a way that I think would be very helpful to us to assess the health of our spiritual life and really be aware of some of the things that we may not have thought of. So she'll also be answering any questions that you have. I already have some questions in the queue that you submitted. So, but if you have any questions, make sure you just drop them in the comment box and I'll make sure that we get to them. So right after the quick show introduction, I'll be right back with Dr. Felucia to talk about scrupulosity. This is David L. Gray in the morning. Hey there, I'm David L. Gray. I'm a Catholic theologian doing my doctoral studies at the Catholic University of America in liturgical catechesis. Welcome to my morning show. We live stream every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with your saint of the day, top news stories, and a commentary on the readings at Mass. If you like what you hear, please hit that like, share, and sub, and leave a comment so that more people can find this program. Thank you, and God bless. And today we're joined by Dr. Felucia Sholaran, a licensed psychologist whose work sits at the intersection of evidence-based treatment, cultural insights, and deep compassion. She's very human. I love that about her. Dr. Felucia specializes in helping high-achieving, highly motivated individuals break free from anxiety, perfectionism, and the uncertainty that keeps them from fully engaging in life with advanced training in exposure and response prevention, a gold standard. Non-medication treatment for OCD, she brings a present, focused, results-driven approach that blends scientific rigor with genuine empathy. Now, coming from a multicultural background herself, Dr. Felucia understands how traditional therapy can sometimes overlook the unique challenges that people face. People are coming from diverse cultural contexts themselves. And so her practice is intentionally inclusive, offering a safe, non-judgmental space with the right amount of challenge to help her clients grow. Her clients often describe her as someone who brings both compassion and accountability, two essential ingredients for real change. And so you can visit her online at skillsetcounseling.com. But now she's here on David L. Gray in the Morning. Welcome in, Dr. Felucia.
Morning. How are you? Good to see you.
I'm glad you're here. I'm excited to explore your work. And I know you speak a lot about on your YouTube channel, which is linked in the description box. You speak a lot about your perspective on anxiety and OCD and the transformative power of cultural informed therapy. Mm-hmm. Is that sum up like what you're specializing in right now?
Yes, from a clinical perspective. And I also just want to put out a quick disclaimer that the information that I'll be sharing today is educational. It is not therapy. And they're interacting with me today is not a patient doctor or a patient therapist relationship at all. So I just have to put that disclaimer out there. The information that I'm giving is for educational purposes. You know, if you need help or assistance, you'll find a licensed clinician and go from there. So thank you for allowing me to put that out there.
Yeah, thanks for that. I really,
and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. I know you asked me a question about.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Oh yeah. Did we get to that?
It was something about, you know, I don't remember the question, but you had
asked. Oh yeah. Are you? Yeah. What are you like specializing in and focusing on? Oh, okay.
So I'll talk about two things. With my clinical focus, it is, I have a couple. So the first is definitely obsessive compulsive disorder, known as OCD, and, you know, related anxiety disorders, basically. And so that's what I focus on, but also integrating, you know, a cultural perspective. A lot of the traditional therapies do not really account for cultural differences, cultural perspectives. And then also I look at it from a neuroaffirming perspective as well, because, you know, many look at OCD as a form of neurodivergence. And so when people are coming in for, you know, for therapy, I want to make sure that they feel seen and affirmed as a person and not trying to fit them into a mold that didn't really account for them. And so that's one aspect. And then my YouTube channel, and then the other clinical aspect is also spiritual abuse. And I do notice that when people are coming from spiritually abusive or high control systems, mm-hmm. OCD can also ride along with that. And so that's what mm-hmm. Those are the areas I focus on clinically. And on my channel, I talk about spiritual abuse, but also more of an expansion to different forms of psychological abuse, especially those that exist in something that I call high control relational systems. And so we can, basically it's a high controlling ecosystem where people are using control to interact with other people. So.
Yeah. And that's interesting, because that's where one of my viewers I've been subscribed to you for a while, so you pop up on my algorithm here and there, but one of my viewers had recommended you, because I was speaking about so in a Catholic church, we have been dealing with this group that wants to separate from the Catholic church, right? Mm-hmm. And so I've been going to like hard on them, you know, they're called mm-hmm. the SSDs. And I had made a video where I described like the 10 signs of a high control group, because I think they're a cult, right? Yeah. And so someone's watching a video and they said, oh, you should check out Dr. Volusia videos. And I said, you know, I'm already a subscriber. So, you know, she's typing in there about that. And she has said, she has like a really great voice like yours, you know, it's just calming. I was like, oh yeah, that's really cool. And then, then she says like, oh, she's like really easy on the eye. And I was like, you know, and not take anything away from you. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you know, you're remarkably beautiful, obviously, but why didn't she say that about me? Like, she said I had a nice voice. But you just, oh, David, you're handsome. No. And it gave me flashbacks, because I remember I was a kid. Dr. Felicia, this is the story people tell. Like, I don't remember, right? I wasn't conscious until I was like 22. people say my family say I was so ugly that my mom had to put me like the most expensive clothes just so people have something nice to say about me. Like they would come up to the crib, you know, like, so she had to dress me well. So yeah, that gave me, that gave me some flashbacks there. I was kind of sad, but.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, but.
No, it's great. But I really like your videos. The one I just watched was, it was like, why you never win an argument with abusive people. I thought mm-hmm. that was a great video. And what I like about your content, I recommend everyone, all my viewers, go subscribe to you. It's like, yeah, you give at least me a different perspective on things. I think about things, you know, obviously different from you. And so I was watching that video, and, you know, when people, I'm in these situations, I don't go back and forth with people a lot, right? But sometimes I'm in situations, you know, where there's a debate or an argument. And, you know, when I'm listening to people, only thing I'm listening for is logical errors. You know, is this a false dilemma? Is this a straw man? Is this a non sequitur? So that's just how I approach it. But then I was watching your video. I was like, wow, maybe people are trying to dominate me. Maybe I'm being abused. So it gives me a different way to think about things. So, you know, I really appreciate your content.
Oh, you know, I appreciate you letting me know how you connected with it. But, you know, when we think about abuse, what do people look for? What do people think about? They think about hitting, you think about marks, you think about things like, you know, cults, right? Some of those doomsday cults and things that you see on the news. But a lot of abuse, which is what I focus on both in my channel and my practice, is the covert types of psychological abuse, right? And so a lot of times people will feel confused. They'll feel, you know, think about a debate or an argument you had with someone and you could shake hands and just, you know, maybe agree to disagree, but like you didn't feel demeaned or controlled in that interaction. Yeah. And then contrast that with somebody who's using that argument not only to dominate, but also to try and distract you as well from the issue. And so I always tell people, let's look at arguments wisely, right? Sometimes, you know, depending on the person, it may be just a waste of your time or even feeding into like an abusive framework you're not aware of.
Yeah. And so let's dive into scrupulosity. I'm going to offer you just the Catholic theological how we see it. Okay. And I would love to hear how you will interact with that just from, you know, clinical scientific perspective.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. So the way I would, you know, define or look at the theological issue of scrupulosity is it being a, from a theological sense, we would say just a distorted conscience in a way. It's a spiritual fear that would see sin where there is none. And scrupulosity would doubt God's mercy. And even after repentance, even after confession, it would still doubt, oh, did it really happen? So we would say that's marked by like imagined guilt, compulsion, self-accusations, a refusal to trust their confessor's guidance. So we would say the problem isn't devotion, is disproportion, is a fear that like overwhelms reason and our peace, especially in confidence in God's mercy. And so, but we have some saints who I think some saints in the Catholic Church who say, oh, that person was scrupulous. They fixated on theirself. They were, you know, they went hard in the paint, as we say, as far as their devotions and right. things like that. People point to someone like St. Thérèse of Lisieux, you know, the little flower, as they will call her spirituality. But, you know, so she was very devout, very attentive to confession, but we would say that it wasn't grounded in like some distrust of God. It was just, she had a sensitive conscience, or St. Francis of the Sales, intensely devout. But he also warned that excessive fear is a temptation, right? So, that's kind of where we would come in on that, like from a theological perspective. How would you respond to that? Is there any intersex?
Definitely. You know, when we think about, you mentioned St. Thérèse, the little flower, and I was reading about how her sister had to tell her, you need to stop confessing every little thing to me. And so sometimes that can be a clue, you know, when it's in the field, it's called excessive reassurance seeking, right? And with reassurance, it's when people are in that realm of scrupulosity, the reassurance never is enough. And that is because like what you talked about, fear and doubt. You know, if you want to get really in the weeds clinically, scrupulosity doesn't necessarily translate to OCD, right? And there are different types of scrupulosity. What we're talking about is the religious type. There's also moral scrupulosity. So being very concerned about being a good person. And so there are people who aren't religious or spiritual who can have scrupulosity simply around morals, right? And so when we look at that and we contrast that with OCD, OCD is a clinical disorder marked by obsessions and compulsions. I as a clinician want to look for impairment. What is this? How is this interfering with your day-to-day functioning? And sometimes when people have scrupulosity itself, it may or may not be interfering with their life significantly. But you know, the things to look for from a clinical perspective are similar to what you discussed. The fear, and also really the intolerance to doubt and uncertainty. OCD used to be, still maybe, but it originally construed as the doubting disease. We all deal with doubt, but when scrupulosity comes into the picture, that doubt feels like torment because the person is always trying to get some certainty around that. So that's how, from a religious perspective, scrupulosity comes into the play. So we can look at it as a spectrum. How does that relate to your understanding of it from a spiritual or from a Catholic perspective?
Yeah, that made a lot of sense. Especially, but I was wondering about, because you said there's different types and different dimensions, and like, can you broaden it out to help us better understand?
Yeah. So, you know, when we think what I can do is really just talk about it more from a clinical perspective. And what we, you know, when in the context that you're talking about, religious scrupulosity, OCD, right? And so when we think about that and we think about religion is abstract. You know, we can't measure faith, right? There's nothing that will tell us there are no tangible signs of the abstract spiritual. And so for some people, that is very difficult to deal with because there's always going to be an element of uncertainty for some people. Do you see what I mean? Like, so for instance, when you go to confession and you're done, there is a certain element of faith that one should have that, okay, their sins are absolved or forgiven. I hope I'm using the right terminology. I don't know too much about Catholicism. So please excuse me if I, use the wrong terminology, but there's ideally the individual would go away and know, okay, my sins are forgiven. I've confessed, right? And even if there may be some lingering doubt, it kind of floats in and floats out. But an individual who's dealing with OCD, those doubts are like red flags or like flashing lights almost. It grabs a lot of the attention. So the analogy that I use when I work with clients is think about your inbox, right? There's some important messages and then some spam works its way into it. And so if you're not dealing with OCD, you can say, okay, let me just put the spam in the spam folder. But if you have OCD, right? Or, and again, I'm not diagnosing anybody here, but individuals typically who have OCD have a very difficult time putting that email in the spam folder. They look at it as the same significance as everything else. And so, let me stop there. What are your thoughts on that?
No, that was good. I think that is the case. I don't know. You guys can tell me in the chat if that's been your experience in confession or coming out of it. But I know from what I hear from people in the work that I do, especially, it's so much, not so much, it would be the sacraments, but it'd be things like the sacramentals that we would call them. So like the prayers. So there's this, as Catholics, we're not allowed to be Freemasons, you know, so. But that's an issue. So sometimes we have people who, okay, they've heard somebody in their family was a Freemason. Mm-hmm. And so we have some priests that say, well, you should pray this prayer. It's some sort of deliverance prayer. Mm-hmm. And so, it's not something I advise people to do. I advise people just to turn to the sacraments, you know, things like that. But, you know, they hear this and they do this. And, but what I keep hearing from them is that they don't know if they prayed it right. And so they keep praying it over and over and over again. Maybe I pronounced something wrong. And so there's never this certainty. So would that be like when you have these compulsions to get something right spiritually?
Right.
Does that flow into what you're talking about here?
It does. You know, there also, to sort of normalize what you discussed, there is going to be an element of uncertainty. When we have OCD and anxiety tend to fixate on or tend to, like, I would say, attack or centralize what is very important to you. So individuals who are dealing with this are actually very, you know, their faith is very important to them. And so that's why they don't want to mess it up. You know, anything, if we really think about it, we can't attain certainty with every single thing in our lives, right? If you go in your car, you put the keys on, you put the keys and start the ignition, you are driving with a certain amount of certainty, right? Believing that your car is going to be fine. It's not going to blow up or anything like that. And so if you think about OCD, people often have a difficult time with that issue of uncertainty, right? And so there are things that we do all the time where we don't need to have complete certainty to proceed. You know, let's say I have like a can of sparkling water here, right? And I trust that it's fine. There are no contaminants in it. I don't have absolute certainty. I'm not going to go run lab tests on it or anything like that. I'm just going to drink it, right? And so we do that in a lot of areas of our lives. But when scrupulosity comes in, there's a fixation, like, I have to get this right. So the example you gave about the Freemasons, an individual in that position who may be struggling with scrupulosity, OCD, would want to really make sure for certain that nothing happened, or that no one in their family is a Freemason. They may ask an older relative, well, are you sure? Well, maybe we should look at family records. And then maybe somebody had like an outside baby that we don't know about that may have been a Freemason. You see what I'm saying? So that spiral will go on and on and on. And so it's important because sometimes people can have those doubts. And look in the Bible, you know, Thomas had doubts. Lots of people had doubts about different things. The doubting isn't really the issue. And what really is important is, how is this interfering with things? So maybe, for instance, if someone is very fixated on the prayers, maybe they're spending hours and hours doing this, causing them maybe to be late for other things or not be mentally present. That's another thing that can come up, is that not being present because your mind just has all these spiraling doubts and worries and trying to get things just right.
And so, because that's important, because it touches on something you said earlier, I noticed, because you spoke about how it can become debilitating. Like, how does a person know that? Because a person may be aware, I can't stop praying his prayers, like, because I don't know if I'm getting it right. David, I'm pronouncing this right, you know, this whole thing. But how do they know it's becoming debilitating, other than what you just said? You said something about, being late to things, zoning out. Like, what's some other things a person can be aware of? Like, hey, I need to do some things here.
Yeah, it's, that's a interesting question. And, you know, it would be difficult to say without seeing the person, but really wanting to understand, how is this getting in the way of your everyday life? Is it causing problems? It may not be apparent right away, but you really want to look at things like interfering with your life. How many hours? People sometimes can be spending hours a day doing these sorts of things, and then it's affecting other domains of your life. And something also I wanted to clarify is, someone says doubting, I see in the comments, doubting isn't the issue. Right, that's correct. It's not doubt, it's what we do with that doubt. Because we have to be, let me rephrase that. When people are struggling with scrupulosity concerns, uncertainty becomes intolerable. And so that's why there is this drive to get that uncertainty out of the way. There's this sort of way of looking at things like, I can't rest, I can't move on until I have this level of certainty about whatever the concern is. Back to the example about Freemasons, asking people, looking in the family tree, things like that. Just really, you know, the thing with reassurance is, you're never going to get enough of it, right? Some point you have to decide, okay, is this good enough for me to just accept and move on? But when individuals are struggling with what we talked about, that can be very difficult. So that's another perspective to consider.
Well, since you cracked open the comm box, I'll take a break from my query and toss in a couple here. So Pius the 10th, which is a really cool pope. What about people who overanalyze their actions and struggle between knowing if they are sinning or overthinking? A propensity to think. To think they are sinning. Let's just go to the first. I don't understand the second one. Can you comment on just like the first part?
I mean, again, you know, I can't make any diagnoses. I have to see the person. But over at, you know, we really want to think about, there are going to be times when people, all of us, are going to do something like this, right? And, you know, especially when it comes to the concept of sin and the types of sin that include your thoughts. Right. And so sometimes, let me explain it from this perspective. So they did a study. I think they found that like 97% of the population has intrusive thoughts, right? Thoughts that we didn't, they kind of just popped into our heads. When we think about sinning and overthinking, sometimes that pattern shows up with something that we can't tangibly see. So if someone is not sure they committed a sin that you can perhaps see, like, I don't know, maybe taking drugs or something, right? Okay, you know you didn't do that sin, but what about your thoughts? People wonder about if they're thinking blasphemous thoughts. Well, does that mean I'm a blasphemous person? Apparently, John Bunyan, the man who wrote Pilgrim's Progress, dealt with similar torment. He was reading the passage in the Bible about how Judas betrayed Jesus, and he kept having these intrusive thoughts about selling Christ, right? Sell Christ. Kept popping into his head apparently. And he became so overwhelmed that he thought that if he were there at that time, would he have sold Christ? So if you've read Pilgrim's Progress, you know about John Bunyan, you think why should he be concerned about that? But again, those thoughts, right? And so and this is something that I think religious environments can do a better job of, is separating thoughts from actions, right? If you, sometimes we'll hear this slippery slope argument about if you think something, and that means you're going to do it, right? And you are that type of person that would do this thing because you thought about it. And there's a difference between thinking about something and doing something. When individuals are struggling, though, they equate thinking and doing. You see what I mean? And so the example of Bunyan shows that. It's called thought-action fusion, but it's getting a little in the weeds of terminology. Just because you think something doesn't mean you are going to do it or you would do it, right? So
yeah.
I know I said a mouthful.
That's really powerful. Yeah, I love speaking with you. Yeah. We're speaking with Dr. Felucia. You can find her at skillsetcounseling.com if you're listening to the audio. Make sure you just drop down into the comment box description box, and you'll see how to reach her. And she has a wonderful YouTube channel. Lots of views on her videos. One of the smartest people, I think, on the YouTube. So we're speaking about scrupulosity and some of the signs and being aware. And she's not offering any, like, she's not doing any therapy work here on individuals, just speaking in general about these subjects. And Dr. Felucia, I wanted to ask you about, so we have people in our family. So we talked a little bit here about like how can some of the things, like myself being like aware of, maybe am I overthinking some things? At what point do I have to find some self-assurance that, you know, I've done enough? Mm-hmm. But what about our friends and our family? Like of a person who has OCD or scrupulosity, will we always be aware of it?
That is a really good question, and you might not be. You might see some things that may concern you. So for instance, maybe not wanting to take communion all of a sudden, or maybe just not wanting to be in church. You know, some people have concerns about what if they yelled blasphemous thoughts, you know, or just out in the service, right? So some of those are some concerns that people have. And so maybe something that they love, maybe they stop doing it, or they're asking for a lot of reassurance, right? Are you sure that I did this the right way? Let's pray this prayer together. Oh, did I get it? or just, you know, asking a lot of questions, right? We all turn to family and friends at times for reassurance, but it can be excessive when somebody may be having these concerns. And so those may be some things to, you know, look out for. But again, you know, the diagnosis belongs to the right professionals. And so family and friends can just be supportive and just kind of, you know, ask what's going on, ask how they can help. And also,
Now I'm going to back up a little bit. I'm glad you mentioned the thing about intrusive thoughts, because I noticed that, and I think it's disappointing sometimes. I think when people may think that's disappointing because they're trying to pray, they may be praying maybe even the rosary, and it's a very repetitive prayer. Like, why should I have intrusive thoughts? I'm saying the same thing. But that can be scary, huh?
Absolutely. And you know, if you think about it, if you have a thought you don't want, there are a few ways that people interact with that. But a lot of times, especially coming from a religious perspective, you're going to want to not think it. And so I'll do a little example with you. So I want you to think about anything you want, but you cannot think about pink elephants. Okay. Think about anything you want. You cannot think about pink elephants. And so I want you to wait a few seconds. Okay. All right. So what was going through your mind?
I was trying not to think about pink elephants.
Okay. What did you see anything? Did something pop into your thoughts when you were trying not to think about pink elephants?
Yeah, pink elephants.
Exactly.
Because I was trying to think about a rhinoceros. Maybe I should have focused on a food or something like that. But yeah.
It doesn't work. Thought suppression doesn't work, right? If you say don't think about something, what are you going to do? You're going to think about it, right? And so thinking about it doesn't necessarily mean that is what you're going to do. And so, you know, people, it's important to understand that distinction. And really the heart of dealing with a lot of these, even if you don't have a clinical disorder, is how do we sit with uncertainty and uncomfortable feelings? You know, a lot of times when people are in these cycles, understandably, that feeling of uncertainty feels intolerable. And so over time, through treatment, people learn to be more comfortable with that. It doesn't mean they like it, but you know what? Maybe you just limit your confession to whatever the amount of confession. Again, sorry, I don't know the entire terminology or how confession works in the Catholic setting, but do what is you're supposed to do and then be done with that. You know, you not make any additional confessions. That's how it may work for some people, you know, different things like that, but learning to sit with that discomfort, which can be really challenging for anybody, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I know a lot of priests, I think we were just speaking about that. We had one of our courses for the program I'm in. We had a class last night and there was like four priests in there. And this issue had came up about parishioners always coming to them seeking reassurance.
Yeah.
And it's a sensitive issue. I know, because I think they were speaking about how the priest sometimes has trouble whether a person's coming to them for reassurance or whether they're just a person who, for whatever reason, needs to be in the life of a priest and know that they approval. I think they need approval from priest.
Yeah.
And so they say, you know, which, you know, how can I know whether this person just needs approval or whether they need self-assurance? What would you say to that?
That's a really thoughtful question. And, you know, I wouldn't know, you know, I don't have a clear answer to that, but what I can mention is that sometimes when people have concerns, it may be, you know, going to see a therapist or clinician doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have a negative label slapped on you or something bad is going to happen. And so if in that setting, a priest or parishioner might say, well, have you thought about talking to a professional about this and maybe putting that out there and just suggesting it? Because it could be due to a lot of things. There may be, you know, perhaps a traumatic event happened, or, you know, there are lots of things. And so getting that support is something that they could recommend if they feel like it would be helpful for the, you know, for the person seeking, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? You said something about like approval or pardon. Is that what you said?
Like validation. Yeah, that type of thing. Yeah.
And then also just, you know, it could be also helpful too to just ask, like, hey, I've noticed you have come for a confession repeatedly about this. Could there be something else going on? Or, you know, what are you looking for? Because if someone is wanting perhaps a sign or absolute certainty, that's not possible. And that's very uncomfortable to think about for too long, right? We don't have certainty with pretty much everything, right? So, you know, how do we deal with that? It's like staring into the sun. Don't look at it for too long, right? That's kind of how we feel when we think about these sorts of things. And so trying to figure out, well, how do we navigate that uncertainty? And is that preventing you from doing the things you love? And so that's why I always incorporate a lot of values-based work with my clients, because for people, their religion is very meaningful. And so what are the values? What are the things you want from life? And is this drive for certainty getting in the way of that? You know, people miss out on things when they're engaged in these sorts of, say, compulsions. Lots of ruminating things like that robs you from things that you probably would like to do when you want to do. And so that's where values are really important.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, how focusing on values can help ease those things that are making you debilitating you and you're not able to move forward. So I think that's a great way to move possibly move forward. So I want to get more into that. Like, what's the lived experience, you know, to help people, you know, maybe self-identifying themselves or some others? Like, what is a lived experience? Like, what does life feel like having this type of OCD or scrupulosity? You know, is it isolating, exhausting? Is there shame? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, there is, you know, first of all, I don't recommend self-diagnosing. I always tell people, you know, make sure you find a good clinician that you trust, that's licensed, that has experience in the field. Because when people typically think about OCD, what do they think about? Think about things like hand washing, right? Or visible things. When, you know, there a lot of what we as clinicians are encountering are more on the mental side, right? And things like perhaps reciting prayers like we talked about, but maybe doing it mentally, things like that. And so the lived experience will vary from person to person, but you'll see things often like just feeling disconnected from what you want to do and feeling almost bound by these compulsions. Well, I have to do this today, feeling shame after. There's a lot of shame that can be involved for some people. Also the idea of being overly responsible, right? We have responsibilities, but when we think about that example you gave about Freemasons, all that research, where is that coming from? There may be a belief about being excessively responsible, having to ensure the safety and well-being of others to an extent that is just over responsible, right? We all have things that we can help each other with, and then we all have things that we're responsible for. So it's going to look different from person to person, but a lot of things can ride along with that, you know, being disconnected, feeling shame, fatigue, thinking about things all day. And then also just somebody explained this really well, that when we ideally our religion, whatever anyone's religion is, you want to have communion, you want to have relationship with others and with God. And so when these things interfere, it now becomes very burdensome. And it's almost like this thing you have to do before you do anything else. And so now it feels like, instead of prayer being a way to find solace, communicate with God, just have that intimacy with him, it now becomes doing it to not feel as fearful, or I have to pray these prayers before I go to drive, because if I don't, then something bad will happen. It's almost like, you know, imagine having a relationship with someone and the only reason they're talking to you is so that something bad won't happen, instead of communality, right? And so I'm not at all downplaying liturgy or ritual. Everyone's going to have their own way of doing things. But what I am saying is that interfering? And if it is, then there's some things to think about.
Now, that was interesting that you said that, the point about feeling that something bad may happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talk more about that, because that sounds like very ominous and scary.
It does, and the fact is, I think something happened with the feed here. Not sure what happened.
Oh, you're still there.
I am? Okay. I don't see your picture.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what happened.
Oh, okay. Yes, fine.
Okay. Great.
Somebody's ringing my doorbell. Sorry about that.
Oh, okay. That's what happened. So, you know, the thing about something bad can happen is absolutely something that we probably don't want to think about sometimes, or maybe you can think about too much. And there are, you know, depending on, I don't know, again, too much about Catholicism, but I can imagine that there probably are some prayers people pray for, like protection. There's nothing wrong with that. But then again, it can be very difficult to tell, which is why you need to be with an experienced clinician that can help you unpack that. But if the drive is primarily, hey, I have to do this so something bad doesn't happen, then that's eclipsing what could be communing with God and having that prayer be part of a ritual that brings meaning and, you know, I'd say, yeah, meaning, solace, yeah, grounding versus got to do this so something bad doesn't happen. Got to do this so something bad doesn't happen. And I have to do this. And it quickly snowballs, right? OCD and these sorts of anxiety concerns, always moving the goalposts, right? So we said the prayer four times today, but, you know, something bad happens. So now you got to do it five or six times. And now you have to do it this way. And make sure you ask this person. It will never, that drive for certainty is never going to be achieved long term. And so hope I answered your question. Wow. We're talking about trying to avoid bad things happening, right?
Yeah.
Which is normal, right? It's nothing wrong. There's nothing necessarily wrong or pathological about that. You know, this is why there's a lot of nuance and good training that is involved in having to diagnose this. Like I said, again, I'm not diagnosing anybody. Yeah. And this isn't meant to be self-diagnosis. But it is important, right? And sometimes people get very hung up with diagnoses. And I can understand that. In my clinical work, I focus more on symptoms, like what's happening and how is it getting in the way of what you want and you living based on your values. So it's okay and understandable. No one wants bad things to happen, right? Or no one is not concerned about it. Yeah. But it's like, how do we interact with that concern and doubt?
Yeah. And I get what you're saying, that it is treatable. I mean, you say, one, don't self-diagnose. If you think there's something that may be there, definitely seek help from someone you're comfortable with, a licensed therapist. But it can be, OCD can be healed, or I don't even know the right word. Is it healed? Or treated? What is it?
Yeah. Oh, that's a tough one. Yeah. It's, you know, there are a few schools of thought on it, and I would sort of construe it as, you know, are you living in accordance with your values? Some people will say, well, if you get in a treatment, all these intrusive thoughts are going to go away and you'll never have to deal with them again. And I don't know if that's realistic for everybody. For some people, it is. You know, for the research right now says that for some people, probably medication and therapy, and a particular type of therapy, exposure response prevention, that's probably like the best for some group of people. Some people don't use medication or don't want to, or may not feel the need for it. But, and then some cases it is helpful. So really it's more about what is that relationship with uncertainty, right? Are you completely trying to avoid it, or are you willing to tolerate it? And then ideally you'd want to put yourself in a uncomfortable, do something that makes you feel uncomfortable, right? I think that's great for everybody. Mm-hmm. Every day, do something that makes you feel uncomfortable. And for all the people pleasers out there, do something that makes someone else uncomfortable, right? So especially when people are dealing with things like moral scrupulosity, right? So sometimes something maybe be like, you know, maybe you don't tell the cashier to have a good day. Maybe you just nod instead and get on with your day, right? I'm not saying go out and be mean to people or be weird. But what I am saying is that when we become acclimated to feeling uncertain and uncomfortable, then it's not as scary. You know, if you think about it, watching a scary movie, maybe the first time you're scared, but by the fifth or sixth time, you already know what's going to happen. It's not as physiologically like activating, right? You're not going to have that startle response when whoever comes through the door with like a chainsaw or something, right? You know what happens. And so that kind of mindset is really helpful for recovery, right? And it takes people, I think I read somewhere, it can take up to 17 years for some people who have OCD to get the right type of treatment, because some of these things are often misdiagnosed. You know, sometimes people might be told, well, it's a spiritual problem and do this. And there are, I mean, I don't look at anything as just having one causation, right? There are different factors. So there may be some spiritual things involved, but the problem can happen when people are just dismissed or told to just relax it away, which does not help. You don't want to do that. You want to confront the thing that makes you feel uncomfortable.
So you don't just tell a person to calm down. That's not going to work.
Yes, exactly. That doesn't work. Or don't think about
calm
it.
Down.
Other than the thing we did with the pink elephants. If you say don't think about it, what's going to happen?
Let me get to some questions, Dr. Felicia. Related to that, and we spoke about this a little bit. I know I'm not going to catch you off guard with this one. Like, to what degree, because some of this could be genetic?
Yeah, that's it could be, right? There's some research that shows that there are some maybe biological or genetic factors. When we think about mental health disorders, oftentimes you can't narrow it down to a single cause. And sometimes, and even causation itself can be very difficult to prove in this realm, but what we can see are correlates, and there are some genetic correlates based on most recent research. So doesn't necessarily mean it caused it. You know, we don't know, but there are, you know, there are some genetic factors related to it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Brandis, my sis here, she doesn't say anything. It's not a question, but more like a comment. I thought she might comment. She says, I found in my life the mental abuse has been far more damaging and lasting than the physical abuse I went through. Over 20 years ago, it happened, and the mental effects are still a fight. Is that rather common?
It absolutely is. In fact, I remember reading something somewhere that the same parts of the brain light up when people are being, undergoing mental abuse, for lack of a better word, psychological abuse. Imagine being called a name, like being called awful names over and over again. The same parts of the brain light up as when somebody is being physically harmed. So that's important. I also just want to put mention this as well, that there are, if you are being harmed or being abused, there's a domestic violence hotline. You know, the number is, I think it says 800-799-7233. So, and there are other, you know, resources as well, even just for education about some of the things we talked about. So it's important that if you are being harmed, you suspect someone's being harmed, there are resources for that if you're, in the United States or wherever. So,
Okay, thank you so much for offering that phone number. You have that memorized? You're just ready to go with that, or did you have to like look that up?
I had to look it up. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I didn't have it memorized, but yeah. Just want to make sure that information's out there. So
yeah, thank you for that. And Marmar says, I've noticed more priests today are using the genius of Jesus' teaching related to our thoughts and actions in their homilies, which I think is a good thing. Your thoughts, Dr. Felicia?
The genius related to our thoughts and actions. I would need more of an example. I don't fully understand the question. You know, if we're talking about priests, talking about Jesus's teachings in the homilies, I don't.
So they're relating some things that Jesus taught and they're connecting it to not so much just narrowing down Jesus' teaching to how we think about things. For example, Jesus in, like say Matthew 25, he would identify with us as the poor, the imprisoned, the naked, and things like that. And so the priest would then turn that around and have us self-reflect and say, are you that person? Are you the poor person? And really just, you know, the humanity of Jesus and how he identifies with us really just have us think about those things in that way. Mm-hmm. Rather than an abstract, oh, Jesus is love, go love people, you know, more just connecting it to the person.
Yeah, I think it would depend on the situation. You know, from the way you described it, I don't know if I necessarily see any problems with that. I do know that for some people, hearing certain sermons, especially when they're dealing with scrupulosity, can be really challenging. The way you described is a way that can help, I guess would help people in that perspective connect with Jesus's teachings. But sometimes you'll see, and I've heard not necessarily homilies, but, you know, sermons or other ones talking about, well, you did this sin that we're talking about, right? So whatever this thing is, well, did you do that? We all struggle with that. And that can be very triggering for people who are already hyper-vigilant about sin. And so something that I heard someone say once is that when we read the Bible, think about what we learn about God and his nature, Jesus and his nature, instead of always being on the lookout for sin. Now, you know, I'm not a clergy person, so I'm just talking about my perspective. Everyone's going to interact with the Bible in different ways. But something else to remember, too, is that there are parts of the Bible that are descriptive and not necessarily prescriptive, right? And so something may just be described. It doesn't necessarily mean this is what you have to do. And so that can be helpful sometimes for people, just even understanding how the Bible works, you know, taking, you know, understanding hermeneutics, for instance, right? The laws of how we interpret the Bible. And I know there are different schools of thought on that as well. So it's not putting this information out there to confuse people, but also to understand like how we using the Bible. And sometimes when people are using the Bible for something that it may not have been intended for, they can become more anxious, right? So I'm going to read the Bible so that I don't feel anxious about these things, right? So it becomes reading all these verses, I still feel anxious. So let me read some more verses and I still feel anxious. Like it's actually not helping. So, or gain certainty, like, will this thing happen? Will this and this happen in my life? Or will this thing, bad thing not happen, or this thing good happen? So you see so even when using the Bible and interpreting it or listening to sermons, we have to make sure that we're using it the way it was intended and not as a tool to make us feel absolute certainty about certain things. And again, I always say this on my channel, people have to think with nuance when we're discussing these things, because you can't say, oh, well, does that mean I should never read the Bible when I'm anxious? No, right? But people would say, oh, you know, got to push back on something like that. You have to think about it with nuance, right? Can you read the Bible and still be okay with feeling anxious about some things, right? And does it mean that you did something wrong or you're a bad person? No.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Marmar is more close. And I think that that's something we talk about a lot on this channel, just the weaponizing of scripture. So yes, I think people just weaponize it. I also think, like you said, people use it as like a magic eight ball. Like they'll like open up the Bible and find a verse of the day like that way, you know?
It's not
a magic eight ball.
And the weaponizing too, especially in these high control relational systems that I talk about, verses will be cherry picked, you know, and you know, people will say things in my comment section. I read about this quite often. You know, there's a verse that says, honor your father and your mother, right? And so some of these people in these very, you know, spiritually abusive systems will say, well, you know, it means your spiritual father and mother too. You better honor them, which really means do what we say, right? And if you don't do it, then these bad things are going to happen to you. And that is misapplication of scripture. And which is why, if, you know, there are some books out there on hermeneutics. You don't have to take a course on it, and just helping people understand, okay, how do we apply it? You know, is this something that is descriptive or is it prescriptive, and understanding the difference between the two.
Yeah. I just love that you were on a show and used the word hermeneutics. That's that made me really happy. And so Marmar was more specific when she says, like, for example, when Jesus tells a parable and one of the two persons not named as Lazarus and the rich man.
So I understand exactly. And I've actually heard that before. And, you know, kind of, when I heard that in that context, I felt like it was used to coerce people to give more money, right? So, hey, you're this rich person and, you know, you need to give this church or this institution more money. But what I learned in my hermeneutics course was that we need to make the main things, and the plain things, right? And so take a bird's eye view of that parable. What was Jesus communicating in that parable? And how do you, you know, being, when they said, okay, you're the rich man is all of us, that's not the purpose of the parable, right? The purpose of the parable is how do we use our resources to serve or help those who are less fortunate. And that's going to look different for different people. So if you're in an environment where they're saying, well, you better give us 50% or whatever, because you don't need the other half, that's wrong, right? The Bible says, decide what you're going to give. God loves a cheerful giver. So right there, you can throw that out. But that is, you know, I see a lot of that taking. One, you can't make a doctrine out of one verse, but you'll see people try to do it. Using words, you know, honor doesn't mean obedience, right? And there's a verse in Proverbs that said, fools aren't deserving of honor. So when you hear this rhetoric about we have to honor everybody and do all this, well, not necessarily. Again, nuance is important. So,
Dr. Felucia, do you think we left anything on the table that you definitely wanted to get to in helping us about scriptlosity that did not come up yet?
I don't know. I probably want to ask you that, since you know your audience very well. Is there anything that you would like for me to touch on more or cover that we didn't talk about?
Yeah, I think I thought from my perspective, we fleshed it out and you guys got any questions, make sure you ask them in the next second or so. But yeah, I thought it was like a wonderful discussion because you framed it. You talked about how it connects to the theological understanding of it and also some signs, some things to be aware about, the dangers of it. Yeah, I thought it was like a wonderful conversation. I just like thank you for like covering it on and spending time with us.
Of course. And I just want to end too with, I know that we've talked about a lot of very heavy things, but It takes work, but people will get to the point. Well, I can't make any guarantees or promises, right? But I have seen in my clinical work, as well as the work of my colleagues, that there is a way out and people do get, you know, can make progress, but it has to be done with the right person, right? You know, somebody who understands what OCD is and is not, and really not weaponizing spirituality or saying, well, you're a bad person because you're dealing with this, or what's the word I'm looking for? Sort of blaming people for doubting. You know, sometimes we'll hear these things. if you had more faith, you wouldn't be dealing with these issues. But if we look at everybody in the Bible, they had their doubts, right? You know, I think about it was Elijah wanted to die, remember? And God didn't berate him and say he was a bad person for that. What did he do? Yeah. He made sure he got food and rest. Yeah. And then spoke to him in what it was like a still small voice, not yelling at him. And so there were practical things that he did. And so, you know, I'm not labeling all churches and religions as bad, but from a spiritual perspective, I get the feedback that people are wanting more compassion instead of an investigation. Well, this is because you did this or you did that. Let's have some compassion and figure out what are some basic needs that may need to be met, and then you know, go from there. So there is hope, and everyone has, you know, their part they play. But I would just encourage spiritual environments. If you're not doing so already, try to figure out how to have more compassion. Doesn't mean no accountability. You can have both. So
awesome. And Marmar, I think it was you who told me that Dr. Felucia had a voice, a wonderful voice like mine, and said she was like easy on the eye. But you see, you and I have to talk about that. It was you, wasn't it? That's really cool. Well, Dr. Felucia, thanks for coming on. Thanks for spending time with us on David Gray in the Morning. I really appreciate you.
Well, thank you for having me. It was really a pleasure to, you know, talk to you, and I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. And hopefully we can have you back sometime to help us do some other things that you're such an expert on. And again, we had Dr. Felucia on. You can find her at skillsetcounseling.com. Also her channel. Just type in her name in YouTube. She'll come up. Make sure you subscribe.
Felucia right there. Yeah. So you just put in Dr. Felucia, you'll find it.
Yeah. Awesome. And that's the best places to find you, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, either one, website or YouTube channel. But yeah, YouTube channel is,
awesome. Oh, one last question before we go.
I don't know her.
No. Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you. See you guys tomorrow. We'll be speaking about, it'll be the Q&A show. So we'll be hopping back into Father Ripperger. Something he said about the SSPX and all the questions and comments you guys said this week, I'll be getting into them. But until then, until next time, blessings and peace to you and to yours.
Hey, yo, wake up. New mercy, fresh light on the way. Coffee in the cup, let the silence pray. Word for your walk, truth for your mind. We read the signs, but we don't lose time. Culture talk, scripture sharp. Faith with rhythm, intellect with heart. No panic, no noise, just wisdom and grace. Morning hits different when you start in this place. Wake up, yeah. Tap in right now, let the truth hit soft, let it hit profound. Wake up, don't scroll past prayer. It's David L. Gray in the morning, meet me there. Yeah, yeah. Think clear, breathe deep, set your pace. Faith ain't heavy when it's put in place. Start with God, then face the day. That's the kind of morning that don't fade away. Like it, yeah. Let it play, share it, yeah. Pass it on your way, sub up, don't hesitate. David L. Gray in the morning, don't be late. Faith and truth. Wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up.